big program for us, so I think it's wise that we get going. So, without further ado, everybody get a seat.
I'm Margaret Backer, and I'm from Port Hadlock neighborhood, and also the neighborhood preparation training team. And I'm glad to see everybody here tonight, even with this weather. And this is Mark Bowserman. He's also from Port Hadlock, Oak Bay, or Old Oak Bay.
Old Oak Bay. Old Oak Bay Road, a little spur road.
Okay. So we're here tonight to do the Map Your Neighborhood training, which is something that we have developed. And it's going to be up to your neighborhood, how you particularly want to put it together. Everybody's got different ways of doing it. But if we could pass these out, one per household. Okay. Let me go this way. This is what we're going to be working off of tonight. And if you can hold that there.
Everybody got one?
Hands, anybody present?
We're good?
Every household's got one?
Okay.
Okay. That's good. All right, first of all, let's go ahead and open up. We call this our shingle because it's kind of set up like shingles. But if you can go ahead and open up to the first page, it says, in a disaster, your neighbors are your closest source of help. Very true. If you don't have neighbors, then, you know, you're there by yourself and you're not sure exactly what to do. This is going to also help you with that. But it goes on to say, learn the 9 steps, and we'll go through those in just a minute. And then create a neighborhood map, which is what you will be doing with your neighborhood leaders. And you might do it tonight, you might do it at another time. It's up to your neighborhood how you want to handle that.
Here's a little thing while we're talking about maps. So I very quickly tonight went online, and I have a document here that is it's a picture of the county map of your area. Okay, and there's a link here that will take you right to that web page. If you go to the Jefferson County website and you kind of navigate through, you'll find something called maps. And so in essence, you can start with this, you know, and then through some fancy graphics, you can do this on PowerPoint, you can do it in a variety of different softwares. Just put arrows and tie your information, personal information to it. That's one way to get started. There's a lot of ways, but that's one way.
Right. We have a gentleman in our neighborhood that knows AutoCAD. He took our flat map and Google Earth and melted them together, so that we've got our houses all set up, and then we went back through and did a propane tank inventory. And so we've got a P wherever they have a propane tank. So it's very easy for you to do. So there's a lot of different things. But even if you just have a basic hand-drawn map, you can do that too. But with the computer out there, it makes it a whole lot better to have, even like what Mark showed you just now. Okay, and then one thing that helps by knowing your neighbors and everything is if you have somebody that might be, how do you put it, medically fragile or needs extra care or something like that, you'll know if, you know, they need to have some extra help during a time like this, because you never know. There's a video that's out there that shows a woman. And her mother was home alone. Nobody even knew that she existed. And she perished because nobody knew she was there. So know who your neighbors are and know if they need to have somebody extra to come in and look in on what they're doing. Okay, and then we're going to go ahead and go to the next page, which is your 9 steps, which is the most important thing that you're going to learn tonight. You want to get your muscle memory going with this. And at home, immediately following the disaster, whatever it is, normally we're talking about the Cascadia subduction earthquake, but there could be other things that would cause you to have problems also. You're going to take care of your loved ones first. That's first and foremost. Take care of everybody in the home. Make sure they're all okay. Then you're going to dress for safety. So what do you keep under your bed?
Shoes.
Hard shoes. You want hard shoes. One of the number one accidents or problems after an earthquake or anything like that, people stepping on broken glass. So you want to have a hard pair of shoes. Sneakers at the very least, but if you've got hiking boots or something like that. I used to do search and rescue. We couldn't even wear sneakers for search and rescue because they said, no, it has to be a good hiking shoe or hard boot. So, you know, but if all you have is a sneaker, that's better than walking around barefoot or in flip-flops. Okay, and then also you want to have a hard hat because of falling debris, you know. Lights come down off of the ceiling. I had one happen in the Landers earthquake. I was in Southern California, 6 miles from the epicenter of Big Bear, 9 miles from the epicenter of Landers. So we got those two really heavy. The ceiling, the light that was on the ceiling in our kitchen came down. Now, if I'd been under that and I didn't have a hard hat on, that wouldn't have been a good scene. Also, leather palmed gloves. Again, for the same reason that you want the hard-soled shoes. You don't want to get cut with glass while you're trying to do things. All right. Then you want to check your propane if you have propane.
Can I add a couple of things?
Yeah.
We're going to tag team this tonight, so we're going to kind of dance around a little bit. So I have a box under my bed, and it has a hard hat, and it has the leather gloves, and it has, I have leggings that I can put on in case, because sometimes in the summer I go to bed and I don't have a lot of clothes on. So leggings, a shirt, because it could be cold outside, right? You're going to want to have a flashlight because it's going to be dark. Now, it's hard to carry a flashlight in your mouth and in your hand when you're crawling on the floor. So a light that goes on your hard hat is really a must. It's good to have two lights, a separate flashlight you stick in your pocket because you want to shine it around in addition, but one on your helmet, okay? A way to keep the helmet on, get a strap to keep the helmet, keep it from falling off.
This is one helmet per person.
Yes,
one helmet per person.
So if your wife and you were sleeping in one bed, then you got double the stuff.
One on each side.
One on each side. Now, another thing that I carry, and I'm unique maybe to this, is that we recommend the use of FRS radios. FRS radios are family radios, basically, and they're small walkie-talkies, inexpensive. You can get them for $12 a piece. I was just shopping for some today, and I put those in my box, or one of those in my box, with batteries, keep it out of the radio, so that in the event I was trapped in the house, and the search and rescue was coming by the neighborhood, and they said, "Is anybody there?" and they couldn't hear me because I was under debris, they're going to go right on by, okay? But if I was able to get that radio and say, "This is Mark, I'm upstairs, I'm close to the south window," or whatever, then they may take a shot at trying to get me. All right, so that's a good thing. A whistle. All right, so if you have bedrooms all around the house, and if you can hear whistles from the other rooms, at least you know the person's, you know, alive. So just kind of think about those kind of things. That's kind of important to have in the box. And then to have your
shingle also.
Your shingle in the box, that's a good idea because you'll be kind of fumbling around trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And then, before all of this, just like you're prepping your box, make sure everything in your house is fastened down as good as you can, the stuff that might fall on you.
Yeah, if you have a lot of glass and things like that, there's a putty that's called Earthquake Hold. It's great. It holds everything down. The only way to get things loose is to actually twist them off. I have it in my house for all my glass stuff that's on the shelves. And that helps to, again, cut down on the amount of glass that you might be stepping on if you're going through your house. Okay. So the next step is to go out and check the propane at your house if you have propane. Make sure that you don't smell propane or you don't hear that there's hissing anywhere around the tank. If there is, shut off your propane because you don't need it to spark and cause a fire. Yeah. Most times, there's not going to be a lot of fire except if there's gas. That's why a lot of areas now are requiring, by law, a shut-off, automatic shut-off at the sign of shaking. Now, sometimes they get a little bit too sensitive and a big truck driving by will turn it off. And then you have to call the gas company or the propane company or whoever to come back out. But
an earthquake valve, so I had earthquake valves put on my house in L.A., Los Angeles. How many from L.A.? Really? Okay. Well, anyway, I'm in L.A., and then when I moved up here, I called and I said, I need an earthquake valve. They said, what? And I said, an earthquake valve, you know, on my gas. So I have an earthquake valve, and the only one probably one out of, you know, 1,000 people that have one.
No.
So
we have one.
Great. So my son was out playing basketball one day, and the following morning I got up and I didn't have hot water. What's going on? So I looked at my hot water heater and I changed the thermocouple in it and I played around with it, and then I went to bed at night and still they had no hot water, and I remembered, I wonder if my dryer has got heat. Went in, the dryer didn't have heat. Ah, the gas is off. Went out to an earthquake valve and my son's basketball had hit the tank and hit just that part that shut my gas off. But the earthquake valve I had in L.A., you just go down, take a screwdriver, go click, and you could turn it back on. This one, you turn, go all the way and then turn it again to get it to go, and, but you have to turn the gas off first. So I had to kind of study up on that, but you can turn it back on if it does false trip on you. And that had, in L.A., they would haul brush down between my house and the fence and knock it off sometimes. So anyway.
So, anyhow. And then you want to shut off the water to your house. At the main shutoff in your house, at your house. Not at the street, unless that's the only place that you have one. But then what happens is you run the risk of any lines that may have gotten broken between the street and your house polluting the water that you have in your house. You've got your water heater unless you have the instant demand. And that's usually, in most homes, 40 or 50 gallons of water. We say 1 gallon of water per day per person for, you know, personal use. There's 25 days for two people if you've got a 50-gallon water heater. So these are the different things. But, you know, they in their infinite wisdom, they put mine underneath the middle of my home.
Oh.
Where you have to get into the crawl space and go way down there, and we're going... We're just turning it off at the street and just turn off the valve to the water heater. And hopefully we'll save it. Yes?
We were told, due to the nature of our trees and the height and the girth of them, that we should be turning our water mains out of the road. So I stuck a wrench in ours and one of my neighbors that's not here very often. If the earthquake... No, because we have a long run of our driveway. Mm-hmm. But if any of our trees tip over in an earthquake, there's a good chance it's going to rip the water line out and drain out the main well long before it hits the house. Mm-hmm. Any exceptions?
I would say isolating it, you must have an isolation valve at the house.
We do have one. We use it when we need to.
I would isolate out the house. I would exercise it once a year because sometimes they'll freeze up. And then you can break them if they haven't been exercised. Isolate out the house because all the water in your house, do you have a two-story house or a single-story?
Both.
All right, so if you have a two-story house, there's a lot of water in that piping. And so the gravity is going to bring it to you.
But if one of our trees falls in our driveway, we're going to drain the entire community well, and everybody will be with
well,
the water.
Well, I see what you're saying. So then I would isolate it at the street and at your house.
Yeah.
I just something that we've told before. If one of our big trees fall over, to go out and isolate it as a road.
Right.
The main, so we left a wrench in our box.
Yeah. Isolate your house, and then isolate that.
Yeah.
Just so that you don't have... You know, you don't want to take the water away from the community.
So. And when the water in your water heater, as it is cooling off, will reach kind of a magical temperature that is good for bacteria to grow. So it's still good, it's a good idea to purify it through some type of purification system before you consume it. You can drain it into your bathtub. They make different kinds of bladders that you can actually put in a bathtub to capture water there. So that's a kind of a lot of stuff to go into. But anyway, you want to save the water in your house. It's an asset.
Right. Okay, now, if you look at the back of the shingle, you see where we've got this okay or help. What we suggest doing is taking two bandages and stapling them to the page here. In case of the disaster, whatever it may be, what you can do to help your neighbors out is, if everybody in the home is okay, stick this up in your window where it can be seen, so that they know, okay, these people are okay and we don't have to do anything here. If they see a help sign, or they don't see a sign at all and there's supposed to be somebody in the house at that time, then you're going to want to check out the house and make sure, like Mark says, if he's upstairs and he can't be heard by anybody, he's still, you know, we know that he's supposed to be home, and obviously he's not able to get down and put his sign up, so we know that we need to go in and check his house out. But that'll come in another few steps here. Okay, then if you have a fire extinguisher, put it out where it can be used by other people if you don't have a fire and they may have a small fire going. Don't try and put out a big explosion with a fire extinguisher. You're never going to get it done. Most fire extinguishers are good for 30 seconds. The bigger ones are good for maybe two minutes or maybe 3 minutes, and that's it. And those are the ones that you can't really carry. So just put them out so that people, you know, if you've got a small little fire in the corner of your house or something, that you can put it out. All right, so you've done all of this to protect your home and protect your family, and you're okay. So now, once you've had your neighborhood mapped out and everything, you're going to come up with a neighborhood gathering site who's got a nice spot that, in weather like this, and you can't go back inside the house necessarily, you can still sit outside or be outside but be protected from the weather.
Excuse me.
Decided on the gathering site, everybody needs to report there so that they can say, oh, you know, whoever's available can go out and canvass the neighborhood and see what needs to be done. Now, this needs to be done fairly quickly because once you get your ham radio set up online, if you have a ham in the neighborhood, do you have a ham radio operator? Okay.
There's several.
Okay, good. Then because you'll be reporting into the Department of Energy Management or EOC, wherever they have set up that, whether it's going to be in Port Hadlock or if they'll be using the Port Townsend Fire Station as the communication center. So you'll be reporting into them on what your status of your neighborhood is. And they need to know that. FEMA, for whatever reason, wants to know the information as quickly as possible so that they can get an idea of what the scope is for the area. Okay. So go to the neighborhood gathering site, and then you're going to have up to 5 or 6 teams, depending on how many people you have. Four teams is basically what they're showing in here. The first team is to listen to the NOAA radio, which will tell you what's happening, or to listen to KPTZ or KROH here. Do you get those two stations here, do you know? I know some areas have a hard time getting them.
Are they just public broadcast stations? Or?
They're out of Port Townsend. They're both on the emergency operation system. And they are 91.1 and 91.9.
And the EOC are linked to them. They can broadcast to them.
Right. If you can't get those here, then your NOAA radio is going to be your best bet to know what's happening. But KPTZ or KRLH will tell you more information as to what's going on locally, as opposed to something from the National Weather Service.
So you'll be listening to that on a battery radio or your car radio?
Another thing is keep your car charged up, keep batteries. A lot of people keep, you know, a dozen extra batteries around them or more, so that you can have batteries for your flashlight, for your radios, for anything. And if you have a cell phone charger for your car, you can turn on, you can keep your cell phone charged that way. And a lot of the information will be sent out also. How many of you have Nixel?
Nixel.
Yeah. Okay. Nixel will be sending them out. Their text service. Text service. Yeah.
I would recommend that you sign up on Nixel right away. It's the first thing that will go out. Cell towers will go down, or there'll be so much traffic that voice communication will be impossible. But there's still a chance that they can send text messages out. And the Nixel is a way to communicate through. You don't text them, but they text you. They'll let you know. So everybody should go to the... You sign up on the Department of Emergency Management website. And just get
once
signed
we send
up.
Out, once we give out the booklet, then it'll have that information.
Yeah,
so you're going to have one team that's going to listen to this and keep the neighborhood informed of what you find out by listening to the radio or and that. And then team two will check on the neighbors who are elderly, those with a disability, or homes with unattended children. Now, I don't know how many children you have in your neighborhood. We just gained 3 for the first time. But... make sure you go up and introduce yourself to these kids in advance, because there's so much stranger danger that if they're home alone and all of a sudden this stranger's coming up to them, they're not going to know who you are. They're probably going to scream or not let you in the door or something like that. Let them know who you are in advance so that they know, okay, it's okay for me to go with this person, because they're going to take care of me while Mom and Dad are away. Okay, so that's you know, unfortunately, that's a fact with today's world with the stranger danger for kids. And it makes it very hard. Okay, then you have your next team. They'll go out. And for people that are not home or people that are not able to get out, they'll go around and check all of your propane. We don't have natural gas here, so that's why we kind of just don't talk about it. But you go around and check the propane and make sure that there's no leaks on these homes, and then shut off the propane if necessary, if there is a leak. And you'll know by the smell or by the sound of hissing. Somebody was telling us the other day that their propane... they had a propane leak, and it smelled like dead animals. Usually it smells like rotten eggs, but theirs was smelling like a dead animal. And they went online and they said, and found out, yes, sometimes it will smell like a dead animal rather than. So
they make a gas detector that is sensitive to propane. It's not specifically, well, you can go online, go on Amazon, and it'll say propane detector, but it covers a variety of gases. And the reason why propane detectors are important is because sometimes you don't smell it. If you're elderly, sometimes you can't smell it. And you're going to want to know right away if there's propane leaking. So that's why you want to get to that LP tank and shut that LP tank off. Because there's the other thing we think, there's the earthquake and then now we have to recover. But there's a good chance there could be an aftershock even larger than the original. And the aftershocks will continue for maybe 2 weeks. Or a month. So moving directly back into your house immediately is not really a good idea unless you want to experience things falling on you again. And a Cascadia quake is not like the quakes we had in California. The Northridge was 15 seconds, 7.2. This could be 5 minutes, far in excess of 7.2. So there's a lot of fatigue that goes on in a house as it's shaking for 5 minutes. And so the idea is to, you know, be prepared to camp outside for a while before you can move in.
Yeah, the Northridge quake, you said 7.2. Landers was 7.4, and it went for about 35 seconds, and followed an hour and a half later by Big Bear at 6.6, which lasted about another 30 seconds. And that's the one that brought down my ceiling light after surviving the Landers quake. But we had aftershocks for quite a while. Mm-hmm. We had parrots in the house, and they would sense before it actually started shaking. I had to get up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work. And at 1:30 in the morning, the parrots would start freaking. And I'm in bed asleep, and I'm like, oh, no, this isn't going to work. We had a motorhome in the driveway. I slept in the motorhome for about 3 weeks until it kind of calmed way down. And in the motorhome, it'd be, whereas the house would still be going like this. So there is a difference. And, you know, the more it shakes, the more you'll notice maybe a crack here and something else there that wasn't there originally. So those are the different things that will happen after a large quake. Now, Landers is the largest I've lived through, and being that close to the epicenter. And I lived a mile from the San Andreas Fault, which is the one that they're really worried about down there.
And they're talking, what, a 7.5 to 8?
Uh-huh.
You know, not a 9.
Not a 9.
Yeah.
So
1,000 times greater than a 7. So.
Yeah. Okay, so now you've got your team out there checking your gas. Make sure the propane's off. There's no hissing or anything else. And then team 4 is going to be the one that's going to go around, and they're going to look for this okay or this help sign or no sign at all in the windows. And then they'll be reporting back to the gathering place. You've got a certain person there that's going to be communicating with them and letting you know, okay, they got their help sign up at this house. This house says they're okay, but, you know, nobody's here. And just keep, you know, informing everybody what's going on. Then once that person back at the gathering place has that information, that you forward it to your ham operator so that they can forward that information to the operations center. But at the same time, if you've got people in the gathering place that can go out, have them go out to the homes that say help, or if they have no sign up at all, and you know somebody's home. Now, if you've got vacation homes and things like that, or people that you know go out of town frequently, let your neighbors know that you're out of town, or you know, that you've left to go to wherever you go to for the winter and things like that. Because if we don't see a sign and we don't know that you're not supposed to be home, we're going to go in and maybe you don't want us in there. So anyway, that's the 9 steps that you're going to do. And if you have this underneath your bed with your shoes and your hard hat and your light and your gloves, you'll go, okay, I'm here. Okay, this is where I need to be at this point. So then when we decide on the neighborhood gathering site, it's going to be a place where you can, if it's, the homes are not usable necessarily, but there's a carport or, you know, some kind of an out area that you're safe from the weather in, then that would be your gathering place, be the ideal place for a gathering place. So, and then you have a neighborhood care center. Now you can have a neighborhood care center set up for children and one for the elderly, or you can have, if that's not feasible, have one that'll take care of both. But if you've got somebody that's really good with kids, and has enough room, you know, let them do that. Also, animals. everybody's got their pets, and they all love their pets, and they're not going to leave home without them. How many people have perished in fires because they can't go to an emergency shelter with their pets? Same thing. So if you've got somebody that's got a big area that can take all the neighborhood dogs or, and cats or whatever in, then you've got it set.
It's a good idea with pets to have your pet carriers accessible, you know, not buried someplace, because you may need to evacuate too in some cases and some disasters. To have leashes for all your pets. We have harnesses for our cats. To have 30 days worth of food, supplies put away for your pets. We just turned ours over a couple of weeks ago. And it just so happens that we have a vet that lives in our neighborhood. So she'll be probably our one of our doctors, human doctors, as well as our kind of a pet person.
So what do you mean by we just turned it over?
So we have, we put food away. We have canned food and dry food that we put into a big black duffel bag, so that if we, let's say there was a forest fire and we had to grab and go, we could go. And that stuff is in the garage, a pretty decent place to get to. And so that would be kind of our emergency backup supply of pet food. We have our standard supply, which might last us 2 weeks maybe, but then we have another 30 days put someplace so that we can get to it.
Maybe things to set aside and he rotates that and feeds that to his family,
right.
And then he replaces it with fresh food.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So we took the food that they used to like and then try to force feed them that because they won't eat it anymore.
Yeah.
So then we have it for lunch. here's another little thing. This is kind of probably a good time to pass things out too. I'll shoot this over. This kind of gives you kind of an overview of everything Margaret's been talking about, kind of just in a pictorial form. It kind of fits in right now.
Out this Think, Plan, Do, Repeat booklet. If you look at the back of it, it'll tell you how to sign up for NCSL. So, if you're not on NCSL, it's a good idea to get on it because they won't tell you everything that happens in the district, but if you have a major road closure for an accident, or if there's other things happening, tsunami warnings, any kind of local emergencies, severe weather, then they will send out a notice about it. And we're going to be going back to doing the second Wednesday of every month to send out one test notification. They haven't been doing test notifications for a while, and a lot of people thought, oh, it's not working anymore. It is, but we just haven't had anything go out since June that needed to be reported on. But if there's a major closure on Highway 20 or a major closure on 19 or even Paradise Bay Road, they've sent them out for that. At least you know that there's something going on there so that you can take action if you need to. You know, if you're driving somewhere and you need to go Paradise Bay Road, well, maybe you need to go a different route if you can. Okay, so that's our little ad about NCSL. Okay.
Who controls the message going out?
That's controlled by the Department of Energy Management.
Emergency
management. I'm going to do that every time. I worked for Southern California Edison for 25 years, and I used to say in the Department of Energy Management because of that.
Jefferson County, Washington Emergency Management.
Yep.
There you go.
Yep. So
they're a higher energy group, though.
Yes, we are.
If they want to test it, they ought to tell us when the bridge is open.
They don't do that one, but you can go to WashDOT and get a notification of bridges.
But then they'll send you messages all day, all night long.
Inside the world, no, the bridge is open.
That was on it. The bridge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. An Amber Alert.
Well, that's important.
Well, I'm in Singapore. I can't do much about it.
No, but your phone number is for here, so you're going to get it, unfortunately. Even though I had a 909 phone number, and I was still, I'd get them for here, too, because I was signed up for things here. Okay. Anyway, on here, do you want to do the go bags?
Sure.
All right. I'll let you do the go bags.
Sure. Here, there's a chair.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you get to sit down, too. So, the go bags... So, go bags. Where's your go bag list? Is that in here? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think it's page 14.
14. So, go bags. So, my go bag experience started when I moved up here from Southern California, and my son was going to Jefferson Community School in Port Townsend, and they're in the tsunami zone. And when I heard about this thing, I went to the picnic that you all go to. And they said, you're on your own. And I said, well, okay. So I started to research based on this information here, what should go into a go bag. And so my son was in the school, and I wasn't going to be able to get to him for probably a week. You know, did he survive? Did he escape? Does he have anything to, you know, if it's snowing outside, could he survive? So I built a go bag that had all kinds of things. So when you think about go bags, you can actually, you may have a variety of go bags. You may have a go bag for the house, which is, there's a wildfire coming, I got to throw that stuff in the car and go. There's that kind of a go bag. You might have a go bag at work. You might have a go bag at school. Typically, the go bag that I really rely on is the go bag that I have in the back of my car. And I have a, basically, what is a black, kind of satchel or a gear bag that you might find online that you might have your baseball gear in, gloves and mitts and stuff, and it's black with a zipper. It's like a duffel bag, big duffel bag, about this big. And I have a backpack in there so that I could take it out and I could put a backpack on. And so what I was thinking is, because my wife is currently teaching in Port Angeles and I get into swim periodically, that I could be coming back from swim, I could be in the car with my son or a friend, and everything could fall apart. We could have this quake, and it's snowing, right? Now what do I do? The roads are blocked. I can't go anywhere. So what would I need to do to survive in that situation? Well, the first thing you're going to want to do is, well, just out of hands, what's the first thing when you think, I'm stranded, I got to shut the car off, it's snowing outside, what's the thing? First thing you're concerned about?
Staying
warm. Absolutely. So you might have a kid in the back of your car that likes to wear gym shorts all the time, right? And flip-flops. So stay warm. So extra down gear, extra clothes, extra socks, gloves, hats, mitts, jackets, layers. One thing that's really nice for a go bag is the kinds of lightweight underwear that you can get at Costco, you know, that you go skiing in or tobogganing in. Very lightweight, compact, very, very tightly. You can get that on. Sleeping bag, all right? Gloves, mittens, hand warmers, the chemical hand warmers that you can get, okay? So now you've got all of that, and it looks like you're going to be... And your car is kind of your base camp. So you can put a lot more in your car than you could ever hope to carry, right? So you've got your warmth handled, but it's dark, and you don't want to really be running your battery all this time. You may need that. You might need to keep that going for... Or hang on to that fuel for a while. So if it's a nice day outside or whatever, you might need to build a fire. So you need to have fire-making equipment, all right? Now you can go get a bow drill, like Bear Gillis does, or you can actually carry Bic lighters, which are a lot easier. So Bic lighters, you might get a spark, a magnesium spark, and have some cotton balls and Vaseline. Those two things together will ignite very easily because it's a petroleum product. So I have three or four different ways of starting a fire, right? Have that packed in there. So now you've got your warp thing going on, you've got your fire thing going on. So what else might you want to have me go back?
Water.
Water, absolutely. So they make water packs. As a matter of fact, I've got a kit right here that you can buy for $20. And it's got a calorie bar. It's good for, this is supposed to be good for 72 hours. It's not a gallon per person per day. But in a car or in a backpack, you don't want to be carrying gallons of water, right? So this actually, if you buy one goes to the school system for free. So you want to have water. You want to have food in your go bag that doesn't necessarily need water to prepare. That's actually got like a calorie break. You can break it off when you need it. You can have different other kinds of foods that you might imagine that you could put.
Chocolate,
absolutely. You know, beef jerky. If you turn your food over, you know, and change it about every 6 months, then you can have pretty decent food. Protein bars, calorie bars, those kind of things, okay? So now that you got some food and you got some water, what else would you need?
Light.
So you're going to want to have a bag of batteries, and you're going to want to have a number of flashlights. You want to have a headlamp, because if you're fumbling around or you're trying to deal with something, you want to have your hands free to catch something. You don't want to have a flashlight in your hand. So you want to have a helmet or something. You got a stocking cap with a headlamp on it and a lot of batteries. Yes?
We have a crank flashlight.
Excellent idea. Crank flashlights are great. Right?
Yeah, crank radios also.
And crank radios. So you're going to want to have a flashlight, you're going to want to have a radio too. Now you're going to have your car radio, but if you're out trying to hike and find some place, that would help. Have maps of the area that you live in. All right? I have the Ludlow Trail map. I have Port Townsend map. I have the maps for Squim and Silverdale. Wherever I am, I have maps in my go bag. Now I also carry a ham radio with me, with a frequency list of the frequencies that are the hot frequencies in that particular area. So if you have a ham person, that's great. He could probably get you up to speed on what it would take to get a ham. A ham license is a weekend. Study a book for 3 or 4 days. You take the test. Pretty simple. You get yourself a ham radio. The whole ball of wax out the door with a ham radio is about probably $50 to $75 to get you the radios, better antennas, box, all the paraphernalia. So I wanted to have that because if I was broken down in Squim and my son's in Port Townsend, how can I find out if he's okay? Right? So hams will leapfrog and link and through a variety of repeaters help you communicate. So communications is important. So now we've got communications for water, we've got some food, we got warmth. What else would we want?
Flares. I have 2 6-packs in my car and I donated one to the sheriff's office that ran out last year during the snowstorm at our gate.
There you go.
Out of flares, and I gave him a 6-pack of mine.
A lot of cars have kind of little cargo compartments. You don't have necessarily put it in your go bag, but they have places that you can put this kind of stuff. So flares would be also very important. You're going to be spending probably overnight in your car, so a lightweight sleeping bag. You can get sleeping bags here go down to 20 degrees. And then get a sleeping bag liner, because just like layering your body with a variety of clothes, a sleeping bag liner, a silk liner, whatever, will add some additional warmth to that. All right, so now you've got your sleeping bag, maybe a small pillow. What's something else that we're going to need to do 5 minutes after this quake happens? Go to the bathroom, right? You're going to want toilet paper in this thing, all right? Probably a couple of rolls, maybe tuck it someplace else in the car. There may be room for... So another thing is shoes, good shoes. So you got all of this stuff, but you got your dress shoes because you just came from church over there, right? Not really great. So I got my wife the little muckluck boots, right? And that's part of her go bag in her car. Because then if she's got tennis shoes on, she can always put those mucklucks on in this kind of weather and stay dry. Rain gear, very important. You can get Frog's gear. You can get a variety of different lightweight gear that you can pack into a kit to keep you dry, all right? So a little umbrella's not bad to have. Also, a good hat or hood, some kind of a marine hat or something to keep the water off of your head is also pretty handy. Not a bad idea to carry an FRS radio because there may be neighbors around that might be on FRS radios or little walkie-talkies. And if you have a child in the car and you're going to go out and look for help, you might want to keep the child in the car and you're going to go help and you want to still talk to them. Okay, so that's something else. What else might you want to go back?
Medication.
If there's medication that you need to take on a regular basis, take some extra. One of the things that Margo will probably talk about is when you're stocking at your house, get out at least 30 days ahead and carry a 30-day supply of extra medication. Right? You can. Insurance companies will usually let you do that. Earplugs, good idea. If you're, earplugs, if you're trying to sleep at night and you need a little extra way to deaden the sound. A medical kit. You're going to want a medical kit because you might a tree might fall in your car. There might be you might have one of these things happen, and that's a long story. But you might get cut by glass, so you're going to want to have a medical kit. Not a bad idea to have a tourniquet. You know, how do you stop the bleed type of things. So these are all things that you tend to collect over time. Now, so you got this orange backpack in the back of your car, and it's an SUV, so you can see right in there and see that thing, right? Well, that says, come on, steal me, right? And in LA, I've had stuff stolen out of my car. So what I did is I put mine in a black gear bag, like a baseball gear bag. It's black. And I tie it to the headrest on the back of the back seat. And it just disappears in the back of the car. You don't even know it's there. And I had the same thing in my wife's car. So that's kind of what I do for the go bag thing. And it's a personal type of thing. If you go to Costco, you can get a go bag for about $35. And so I want you to go out in the woods some night and try that. You know, a good go bag is going to cost you $300 to $400 of stuff. It doesn't have to be that expensive. You can get a lot of stuff. You can make up a lot of the stuff for cheap. But it's one insurance policy where, you know, the insurance company isn't going to call you and say, sorry, we're not covering you. Right? It's an insurance policy that you will have forever, providing you can kind of camouflage it. Okay? Anything else you could think of going to go back?
Rope and tarp.
Rope and tarp. You're going to want to make a tent. So I just bought a tent last week. I bought a tent from mine. You can get a tent. It's a two-person tent for $35 at Big Five. And it is about that big around and about that long, and it will pack inside that satchel. Actually, in my wife's Prius, I found a hole underneath where the spare tire was. I could park that. So a tent and plastic and rope, okay, or twine. They call it parachute cable, okay, a paracord. So that you can build yourself, you have your tent, but you might want to get a piece of plastic over top of that to keep that dry, or a piece of plastic underneath your tent. So plastic.
And if you don't have a tent, you can make one with just
plastic.
The tarp and the paracord.
There you go. It just depends. So the difference between a Navy SEAL and me is that I need a 35-pound go bag, and he has an Altoids can, right? And that's how he can survive. So while I haven't had the Naval SEAL training, and I don't necessarily like sleeping in the nude in a foxhole, I prefer a little bit more stuff, and so that's why my go bag's a little bit bigger. But keep in mind, go ahead.
I was going to mention, you talked about toilet paper and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Use your vacuum sealer and take the
yep.
core out of it, and you can squeeze it down to almost nothing.
Yeah.
And then when you need it, you pop it open.
Yeah. So I have a vacuum sealer at home, and that's exactly what I've done. Toiletries. You're going to want toiletries, you know, because you might want to brush your teeth. You're going to want water purification. So you got your bottled water, you got your bags of water. But when that runs out, you're going to want containers to gather water, and then you're going to want purification for that water. And there are a variety of purification technologies out there. A filter, a life straw, a variety of different things out there. Try to find water filtration devices that are down to viral levels. Okay. Because if you use one that isn't, and you happen to get the water out of the wrong place, and the virus gets through, you can't go to the hospital here. If you're going camping, we'll take you to the hospital. But in this condition, you want to have belt and suspenders. So you want to have good quality, third-party tested water purification. In addition, you can get tablets or liquids from a company I particularly like is Aquamira. Aquamira is a company that makes water purification systems and chemicals, and they make droplets that you can put in your water that it take about 30 minutes, and it will purify the water of any bacteria and those kind of things. So just like if you're on a district water system, they're going to use filtration and chemical treatment to really purify your water. So water purification and filtration is important to care.
Okay.
and containers that you can actually gather water in. Some have water bottles that have a filter straw, which is not bad. And you can get also collapsible water bottles that can be used to go out and gather water.
I don't know how many of you heard, there was a couple lost in the mountains down in Southern California back in June or May, I forget. And they had a life straw with them. Now, the life straw is 99.99 filtration. It takes out almost every single thing that there is. And they survived with berries that they found and their life straw with their water, because they had no other water with them. They were only going out for the day.
Yeah, a life straw, it's not belt and suspenders, but for God's sake, I have a life straw too. I have my water bottle and my life straw is my backup.
You can put your life straw straight into a stream of running water and drink right out of it.
Yep.
And there's no problem. And I saw something very interesting yesterday. There's water lily, water turbine. And it actually produces electricity if you get it into a area of rapids on, or else if you've got a good wind. And it will charge your cell phone, it will charge your tablets, it will charge your laptop for you. And it's pricey. It's like $200 for this item. But, again, you know, it's another backup that you can have. But you can do a lot of your go bag at the 99-cent store.
Oh, yeah.
At Harbor Freight for free if you get the coupons. You know, you go in, you buy a dollar, and you can get three different items that are available on the coupons. You know, it just says free with purchase. All you got to do is buy a dollar whistle or something like that, and you get all of this for free.
A dollar store is your best friend. Dollar store, and absolutely, best recommendation in the world. Dollar store and Harbor Freight. You know, and then you get creative with this stuff. So when I said $300, that was my first pass at it. But if you get really creative, and as a group, you start to like make a master list. So what I did is I actually, in my research to build a go bag for the school, and then they wanted me to build go bags for all the kids, I collected all of this information, and I got 300 items on an Excel spreadsheet, which is my shopping list to choose from, depending on the size of the bag and what I'm trying to do with it. So that's one of the things. You could actually have a go bag committee in your neighborhood and just say, let's sit down and master out a go bag and then send that stuff off, you know, distribute it to your neighbors. So it's a variety of different ways. Am I missing anything?
No. Not at all. One thing is, now, as far as your neighborhood for getting your 30-day supply of food and water, some neighborhoods have been able to get a Connex box or a shed or something if there's a location like that, or if they have a community center. Or there's one area that this gentleman had a shed that he was not using. He turned it over to the neighborhood for them to store their food and water in. He's up the hill. He's not going to be inundated with any tsunami or anything like that. And so they, as a neighborhood, came together. You don't have to do it on your own. You don't have to do it as a neighborhood. But if you can, it makes it a lot easier overall for everybody because, okay, you like your chocolate. You can't abide chocolate, but you can. You want your nuts, and you want your veggie sticks, okay? You know, you can bring it all together, and everybody can share with everything. Or if you just want to be miserly with your chocolate, you don't have to share it. You know, it's. We have one girl that does training, and she goes on about this, so that's why I'm picking on it.
Yeah, you guys are kind of in an interesting situation. You're kind of at the end of the road. That little handout that I handed out, it's got the picture of the neighborhood. So if this was the Port Townsend neighborhood or Port Havelock neighborhood, you also might have 50 school kids camped out at your house or in your neighborhood. Not so here, all right? So you could probably cross that off. And just about everything else in terms of retirement village and businesses, you're kind of out at the end of the road. So the secret weapon, though, is the neighborhood, okay? That's your big go bag right there. And one of the things that we're doing in our neighborhood is we're having a meeting probably 2 weeks from now where we're going to get together and we're going to I created a skill sheet here. There's one in the book, in this book here. And basically, y'all sit down, and I'll leave some of these here. You can make copies. This is just my version. It's not casting stone or anything. But what it does is it goes through for everybody here, and you fill it out. You've got your name, your family name, persons living in the house, those names, disabilities that might want to be known, pets' names, where your LP is shut off and water shut off, and whether you need electrical for critical care. Okay? If somebody needs an oxygen pump or something, then that's something we're going to want to know about that.
So by the way, this information is in your neighborhood only. We do not want it as part of neighborhood prep. We do not want it. Department of Emergency Management does not want it. But it's for your own edification. What happens is if you've got a doctor or a retired doctor, and he puts it down that he's a doctor, just because you meet him at a party doesn't mean you can go up to him and say, hey, doc, can you do this for me or check this out for me? No, it's only for emergency.
Yeah.
Do not take advantage of the fact that you know that they've got this.
One of the things, the first thing we're going to do when people come with this form is we're going to discuss how do we want to manage the information. Now, we have a couple of neighborhood leads. I'm one of them. I've got one that I'm enrolling who is a past paramedic and a police officer. He's at one end of the block, and I'm at the other end. So they may all say, look, we trust you with the information, but you two guys have it, right? So there'll be two of us. And then I may have a third as a backup, and we'll keep it someplace, you know, if that's what they want to do. But we have 12 families in my area. But in this particular case, it talks about the various skills: first aid, firefighting, search and rescue, pet care, child care. Those are skills. And you can do zero, basic, highly proficient, which would be, you know, kind of give you a skill level. And then you go to equipment and supplies. And I say, you know, please fill this out if you're comfortable with sharing this information. And so you put down these kind of tools. So if all of a sudden we're doing a search and rescue and we've got to crib something up to get something off of somebody, where are the crowbars? Well, I know John's got one and Frank's got one. Go to Frank's barn and get his crowbar or get his big lift or something. So these are the kind of things you're going to want to know. And then as you kind of optimize the communication and you're bonding with your neighbors, you may want to set up teams in advance. Now, she just went through some of the teams you're going to want immediately after you have the quake, but you want to, in advance, maybe decide, okay, for instance, how many people here like to cook? Okay, how many people are good for cooking for a large quantity of people? There you go. There's your chefs. So they go in your food category. How many people here have bad backs? Okay, some of those people, it's good. A lot of them seem to be the cooks. But those could be your ham radio and NOAA listening people, right? How many people are pretty sturdy and they could go out and help pull somebody out of the building? Right, all right, so there you go. So you start creating what those teams look like. Not hard and fast, but it just kind of gives you an idea of who's in the wagon train, right?
How many have chainsaws?
There you go. Chainsaws.
35 homes and 38 chainsaws in my neighborhood.
There you go. Right? So you've got it. You begin to get it. So if I'm going to talk LP gas, and I'm a person that's, I'm a lady that's living at home, and I have an elderly husband, I don't know from LP gas, right? You know, Frank, do you know about LP gas? Yeah, I got LP. I'm all over LP gas. And generators, I got that handled. Great. You can be part of the generator team, right? Or the LP gas team. So you create teams, and then once you kind of figure out what all those teams are and that you've covered all the bases, and on the back of this little sheet, I've kind of listed out some of the skills you might want to have, then when you have your meetings, you don't have to have 24 or 25 people show up for a meeting, an emergency meeting. You may just want to have the generator team show up, or the fuel team, or the shelter team, or the medical team show up. So that way you can kind of boil this down to kind of bite-sized, specialized areas of expertise. And an analogy I was sharing with Margaret earlier is that you have some people, when you come to meetings like this, you're lucky, in some cases, to get maybe 30% of the neighborhood. You know, and then 60% of the neighborhood doesn't show up. They're busy, or they don't care, or they don't believe we're going to have an earthquake. But when the party happens, they're all coming, right? So that gallon per water per person per day, really, if you can afford to do it, and you've got room to store it, store more. Medical supplies, store more. Store more than you think you're going to need, that you can, you know, you can afford to store financially, that you can handle. If there's a lady that lives across the street, she's kind of elderly and she doesn't get out much and doesn't talk, you know you're going to have to cover her. So this is kind of how you got to play this, right? You are the first responders. You are the first responders. The first responders here may not see you for weeks. It could be a long time depending on how bad things are, right? I hope that's not the case, but it could be quite a while. So it's a good idea that you're resilient and that you. This will become a commune. If you've missed the 60s, you know, Pots legal now. Peace, love. This may be a commune, right? And, you know, my dad and mom were raised on a farm and they lived next to the Amish. So you basically are going to be functioning as kind of like high-end Amish. That's kind of the way it works. If you went to an Amish couple and said, well, we're going to cut off electricity for a month, they go, yeah, so, right? So that's kind of the way it could look. But anyway, that's just a way to kind of organize this. A lot of what you're hearing today is there's a lot of stuff coming at you, and it comes down to kind of organization. And talking about go bags, talking about the stuff you're going to stockpile in your house, okay, we talked about the food and the water and the booklets. If you do everything in the books, you're going to be covered. I had a problem because I was trying to collect stuff from my son's go bag and from my go bag and my wife's go bag. And my living room and my kitchen filled up with boxes and boxes and boxes of Amazon stuff, right? And my head wanted to explode. So what I finally did is I went out and I got myself a storage rack system at Costco, bolted it to my walls, got my bins, labeled the bins, and then I started to sort all the stuff out of my living room and kitchen into my bins. And now I can take you to my medical bin and my cat food bin and my shelter bin and my tent bin and my cooking gear bin. If you're going to be cooking outside, by the way, you're going to want some cast iron. So you're going to say, oh, in the group here, how many people have RV type of cooking gear or camping gear? Right. This is not Tupperware. Okay? It's a different kind of gear. So you're going to have your big cast iron kind of things, right? Your Dutch ovens and those kind of things. And then LP gas, how many people have LP gas? How many people are all electric, 100% electric? Oh, that's beautiful. Well, you got one person. You are? Okay. LP gas is going to be real critical. You're going to want to maintain it. Just like your car, you never want your car to go below a half a tank of gas here. Because your car is your first backup generator. It's going to give you electricity. It's going to give you communications. So I always, when I get down to 50%, man, I'm filling it up. LP gas, don't let your LP gas tanks get below 50%. The local gas company say, well, we'll come out at 30. No, you're going to come out, I get filled up to 80, you're coming out at 40, right? You may want to install a larger LP tank. LP tank capacity is cheap. It is so cheap. It is pennies. Take the old tank out, 250-gallon tank, put a 500-gallon in. I have a 250, I fill up 6 times a year. It's crazy. I should have a 500. And then never let it get below 100. And if you have a generator, that's another thing, to take a look at generators. Electric generators, they should be LP gas or dual fuel, so you can connect them to your LP gas system. Because gasoline would disappear.
Yes. I mentioned something. I have a 1,000-gallon propane tank.
Good luck. Good to know.
It's okay. But my point is this.
Yes.
It probably paid for itself in 2 years. Because when you own your own tank, you negotiate the price. And I always call, and I find sometimes it's 30, 40 cents a gallon difference.
We did the same thing. They tried to, we sank a 500-gallon tank, and they shot us at 50 cents more than everybody else, thinking since we just moved here, we wouldn't know better. And then once I saw Senex's prices, I called them, and they're like, yeah, we'll give you a big reimbursement. We're sorry, and we'll need their prices.
There you go.
Yep.
So owning your own tank.
We're looking at the bill.
Yeah, owning your own tank. So when you look at how many people here have big fireplaces that burn wood, okay?
No,
good idea. Good idea. Those that do, that's a great thing. But if you have a you know, these kind of fireplaces that you've got an LP gas for it. And but at least you have some LP gas. It puts your team together. You have experience here. You have skill. And decide what size tank would I want to have, what kind of generator would I want to need to backfeed my house in a safe way, come up with a design. That's one of the things I kind of do on the side. And size your tank for how many days of operation you're going to need on your critical loads. It could be a little suitcase generator just to get a little few lights on in the refrigerator going, or it could be a whole house, all the way up to a whole house generator. But then it's all about longevity. How long is that burn, that tank going to last in your, if you're in a rationing mode? And you're going to want to bolt your tank down, which is going to become state law shortly. You're going to want to put an earthquake valve on it so that it shuts off the gas to the house, so that's not an issue. You can reset it if there's a problem. You may want to put a low-pressure manifold at the tank head. If you have gas coming to the house and it's feeding a variety of utilities or things in the house, hot water heater, dryer, or whatever, and there's a gas leak in the house, now you shut off the gas at the tank. Now what are you going to do with the gas? Well, all your low-pressure regs are at the house, and you're sitting on high pressure at the tank, or you know medium pressure where it leaves the tank. Now what do you do? Well, you're kind of stuck because you can't run your barbecue with it, you can't run a generator with it. So what I did is I put a low-pressure rig at the tank end with a connector so I can connect a hose, a quick connect, so I can hook up my barbecue, a portable generator, a crab cooker, so at least I can have hot water to take a little sponge bath once in a while without the gas going to my house, because I can isolate the gas to the house if there's a leak. Something else to think about. There's a brochure back there on that. AmeriGas happens to be the only company anchoring tanks. Okay? And so if you don't have AmeriGas, talk to your tank, your if you have a gas supplier and they own your tank, tell them you're going to need to have your tank anchored. But anyway, it's just something to think about. There's a lot of, in Ludlow, a lot of all-electric communities, and what we told them is to go out and split the cost of 2 500-gallon tanks in the community and plop them in corners of your neighborhood, and then possibly take some training. In this case, it only would come from AmeriGas, to very specialized people that might be trained to actually fill a 20-pound tank, barbecue tank, from a larger tank. And that's something that nobody likes to do, but farmers do it. Farmers do that. And if you have the right kind of people with the right kind of training and they're certified by the gas company, you may be able to get that training. Yeah.
You've actually experienced that has happened.
What's that?
The gas company has offered to train people to do so.
AmeriGas will consider it if they have the right person to train. They don't train a lot of people, but if it's an AmeriGas product and it's for a large community and you have a competent person there to do it, they would consider it. But it's not to be advertised. They don't love to do it. But farmers do this. And in an emergency situation, you might want to have that skill set in your neighborhood.
Now, you're wondering why we keep harping on strapping your tank down. I don't know how many of you live on a hillside, but if your tank is not strapped down or underground, during one of the hurricanes down in Houston, I think it was, they had all the tanks float out to sea. Now, once it's hit salt water, it cannot be used again, but these tanks are full of propane. So what was the answer? They rounded them all up in flotation and bombed them because they were floating time bombs just sitting there. So it was easier for them to do the roundup and bomb immediately so that it was a controlled explosion rather than just all of a sudden, here goes one, you know. And it made it... made sense to do it that way.
The code requires that if you're in a flood zone, that your tank be kept from floating, okay? Which would mean that you would anchor it. When Hurricane Sandy hit and they had this huge storm surge, it got around tanks and floated the tanks. And when the tanks broke loose, and this is mind-boggling, But when a tank is broken off of its mooring, and you have that little quarter-inch copper line that's snapped, believe it or not, there can be sources of ignition in that process, which can cause that tank to ignite. And I've got videos in a presentation I do showing LP tanks going down a street, floating down a neighborhood street, ignited on fire. So if you happen to be in an inundation zone, if your tank's above ground or below ground, they need to be anchored properly, not just below ground, because they'll float. You put enough water above them, they'll pop right out of the ground unless they're actually anchored to footings underground. So in an inundation zone or in an area where a tank could break loose or a tree could fall on it or all those kind of things, you want to make sure it's anchored. Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, when that happened, there's a company back there called Minuteman. Minuteman makes mobile home anchoring kits. In Florida and wherever they have hurricanes and tornadoes, they have anchoring kits. They're basically earth augers that they screw into the ground and they tie cables on and then winch those cables down to hold the trailers down so they won't blow away. And they use the same technology for anchoring tanks. So what they did is FEMA contacted Minuteman and they came up with a protocol, an engineered protocol to do that. And AmeriGas happens to have that protocol and they carry the earthquake straps and the anchoring straps for those tanks. And they're now starting to anchor quite a few tanks.
So, does anybody have any questions as far as what we've talked about so far? Okay, there's one last thing that we do want to talk about. It's not the most pleasant subject, and we didn't bring the visual aids tonight, but it's called the twin bucket system.
Oh.
Now, we've... we've done our gallon of water a day, we've got our food and everything, and we've been having a good time, but all of a sudden, what do we do? What's the next thing that happens through nature?
Nature,
right. Okay, so...
You got a kid.
Everybody here is on septic, I was told.
Yes.
Okay, so...
It's a good thing.
Yeah. We have what's called the twin bucket system, and there's a little bit about it in the Think, Plan, Do, Repeat book that we handed to you. And there's also a brochure on the back counter back there with it. You want to have one for pee and one for poo. You can name it anything you want. One, two, pee, poo, whatever. Whatever you want to do. But anyway, you want to separate pee from poo. Now for women, I know sometimes that's a little bit harder to do. But try your best, is all we ask. Because what you're going to do is pee in the one, and then use the other one. And once you've done your number two, then you're going to go ahead and put in either coconut fiber, which you can get.
No, time out. If they have a septic system.
Okay.
If you have a septic system, you're kind of golden in a way. Okay.
As long as it can be pumped out.
If you have a septic system and you can open up your septic tank lid, then you can dump your poo and your pee into the septic tank. Now, you may have a gravity system where it goes down to your drain field, or you might have a sump pump system where it pumps up. For a period of time, you can pour it into this tank. Nothing's going to necessarily back up in the house because nothing's working. The water depends on the conditions of your of this quake, right? But you can actually almost set up. You get yourself, work up, you got your tarp, work up a little tent type of thing and make yourself a commode until you can move back into the house to where you can go in the buckets and you can take it and you can dump it into the tank. You can even take the tank lid and modify the tank lid and turn it into almost like a toilet. Put the bucket on the top and do it that way, but you don't want to have it around any kids or anybody who wants to drop anything in there, okay? So it's probably better to dump it after the fact. If you don't have that, and you're on a system where you don't have a septic tank, then you have to collect the pee and the poo in the buckets, seal the buckets, and at some point, the emergency operations or the DEM, Department of Emergency, will notify you into what you're going to do with that. if you're on a system, like the Ludlow system, they'll probably contact you and tell you, we're going to send trucks around to pick up these buckets and then return the buckets. Nobody has really processed that down to the fine-tuning yet, but that's kind of the situation. They don't want us to bury it because our ground up here and our water tables are not conducive to that kind of thing. We can actually make the problem worse.
You do not want to pollute the water system.
Yeah, and most of the bad things, the bad germs, are in the solids and not in the liquids. So right now, the simplest thing to do is just go get yourself a stack of buckets from Home Depot or whatever. And a pair of buckets are good for about a week, I think, right?
Depends on how many people.
There's a magic graph or chart in one of these that kind of explains that.
Okay. For one person, it will take 14 days to fill the bucket.
Yeah, but you may not want to fill them all the way to the top, so get some extra buckets. You may have some guests, so get some extra buckets, you know, and just have some extra buckets around. You don't want to put plastic bags in them. You don't want to try to take the solids out and put it in a plastic bag and tie it. Just imagine what it's going to be like to try to handle that in an effective way. You know, you can pick up buckets and stack buckets on a truck, but the other way would be real difficult. A fun fact, the quake that they had in Japan, which is the sister quake of what we're going to have someday, okay? I attended a seminar when the Japanese contingent came over around where the Fukushima power plant was. They came over and they talked, and they said the biggest problem that they had in recovery, and they're experts at this because they've been doing this for thousands of years, was sanitation. And how to manage sanitation properly. They didn't know how to do it really effectively, and they tried to do it as good as they can. And the best thing that we've come up with is the bucket system, and that came out of Christchurch in New Zealand. They actually came up with this concept, and it's been adopted in Seattle and all over the coast.
It actually started down in Oregon, and it's now been moved up here. The biggest thing is they didn't have a sanitation system for 3 years after their quake. So this is what they came up with. And once you've done the poo, you do need to put a desiccant, shredded paper, anything of that nature in there, wood chips or wood sawdust. You know, if you've got a woodworker in the neighborhood.
They recommend that you don't do that if you're going to put it in a septic tank. If you're going to haul it away, that's what you do. But if you're going to put it in your septic tank, you don't want to put anything in it that will compromise your tank. Okay? So that's the caveat in those two scenarios.
Is there a downside to just taking a shovel and going out into the woods?
Yeah.
Surrounded by quite a few.
It's just because, I mean, when you're going out camping, and you're all by yourself in the middle of the nowhere, then that's not a problem. Right. But when you have thousands of people doing that, that's a big problem. And it's just the fact that our soils don't percolate that well to process the bacteria.
And our water table is very high.
Right.
So you stand the chance of polluting the water system for the entire area if you have everybody doing that.
In fact,
it's actually against the law.
Yeah, you're talking serious disease now if you do that.
You know, how they're saying that the typhus and all of that has made a comeback in the homeless community down in L.A.? That's what we would be looking at.
Are there exceptions? We have 300 acres and 17 households out here. And, when I worked in Yellowstone, where millions of visitors would come through, they would say, take your shovel and bury your stuff off of the trail in a safe spot and cover it up. But if we're 17 households on 300 acres-ish, give or take, a few dozen, is that still an option?
Not advised.
The P is pretty much sterile when it comes out. That would be maybe the only thing that you would do. But I would not recommend the solids, because that's really the thing that's going to get, if it gets into the water system, and you may not have a hospital for 30 days or whatever, the first thing they're going to try to do is get you out of here. If you have another home, if you have another place to go, if you have relatives, get out of here, because then it's just less people they have to manage. But the recommendation is don't do that, because if you just left that in the woods and now you've evacuated and now somebody else has got to deal with that, get into the water system, not a good thing. It's just another problem to try to solve, and you want to minimize the problems.
I'm going to build an outhouse for the ladies only, right above our one of our big septic tanks. Guys, sorry, you're all on your own.
I will tell you, I did that when we were building. I built a 4x8x4. If some of you remember that. Mm-hmm. And I put a real toilet over it.
There you go.
And flushed it, and it, workers loved it.
So how many people, who here wants to volunteer as a sanitation expert for the team? Oh, I think right here.
I put it back in.
He's not here the whole time.
I have a slide in my presentation exactly that.
I had it. In fact, it was, is Jerry here?
Yeah.
It was on a Jerry septic tank. Because that's where we had the trailer at the start.
How many people have RV trailers here?
What do you got, Bob?
Anybody have RVs? Yeah, that's kind of nice to have if you happen to have one. You know, I think that comes along when you move up here. How many people have tents? How many people have tents? Okay? If you don't have a tent, you might talk to your tenters and come up with the best tent for long-term, you know, camping in the middle of the winter. You know, whether you get dome tents or four-wall tents that you can add packing blankets to add additional insulation or whatever. That can be part of your tent team, you know, your shelter team.
One thing I want to add, though, is I built myself a survival kit for two of us about 2 years ago, and we pieced it all together, and we had a big backpack from Ari and I, and with hand warmers, lighters, everything. And the problem is it weighed more than Victoria. And when we stepped it in the hall closet, and one time we go lift it, it literally weighed more than her. So one thing to keep in mind, maybe some small, easier to carry.
Another option is to get a backpack on wheels. Get even a suitcase with wheels on it.
Or multiple, if you need, to make two trips
right.
Or something.
Remember I said your car, and I have a...
So the problem with the car, though, is I heard that in the emergency, you're going to end up on foot because by the time we get out our gate, there's going to be a traffic jam of 50,000 people trying to get to the canal bridge.
Well, the bridge isn't going to be working.
Exactly. So if there's no bridge and we're on the water, we're surrounded three sides of water. And if the earthquake hits, there's a good chance there's a tsunami following.
How many homes are here?
And so we have a meeting plan to meet at Keel Lake if we're separated, whether it's by foot or by car, because that's where the two of us have decided if there's an emergency, we drive as far as we can, and then we get out and just try to get to the highest ground away from the water as possible and hope that.
In Port Townsend, we're talking what? The new model is 30 feet, they're recommending 50. Don't put your lawn chair at 50 with your feet waiting for the water to come up to your feet. But
we actually, in Port Townsend, they want to go with 100 feet. There's a battle going on with FEMA right now.
100 feet higher in elevation?
100 feet in elevation. So if you're above 100 feet in elevation, you're going to be okay. If you're below 100 feet,
That's Port Townsend, but by the time it gets down here, you're not necessarily talking about what Port Townsend is going
to
see.
But there's a good chance we're going to have to abandon our cars at some point.
That's true.
Far away and try to get to higher ground eventually.
The model that you are designing to, keep in mind that you could be somewhere between here and Squim, in which case you may be on high ground and now it's just snowing and so. What I do is I put more than I need because I could have more than one passenger. And I can always leave stuff behind.
Yeah.
Right? And then I load my bags to what I think I'm going to need in that scenario. If it's in the middle of summer, maybe I'm not taking all my winter clothes, right?
For me, I just found that two smaller bags was much easier than one really heavy, large one for those of us who overpack.
Very good thinking.
30 gallons of water. That's a lot of weight.
Exactly. Carrying water, and that's why the life straw and all these other purification scenarios are so important, because the water is going to kill you, right? So you would be a great consultant here in the group to sit down and help them process that, because you've processed that. And it's a great way to kind of team lead the kind of stuff you want to do.
I have a question.
Yes.
We're talking about earthquake, possible follow-up tsunami. What about an emergency situation such as something nuclear? North Korea sends an ICBM, hits here, because certainly all of our naval facilities could be an attractive target. What changes in what you've shared with us today?
Well, you're gonna if it's a fallout situation, you want to seal your house up airtight as much as you can.
Do you have literature on that?
No, not on us. That's not something that we really focus on. But actually, I have the pills. You can get the iodine pills, and
what is that for?
For radiation. It helps protect the thyroid, I believe. And there is literature on that. If you go and just basically Google it, and they'll tell you some practical things that you can do. I know in Los Angeles we were concerned at the harbor that a dirty bomb could go off. So I would take a look at that. That's kind of a special situation. And sorry to say, in this world, it's starting to become something on somebody, all over our radar.
Right.
You can imagine if everybody tried to evacuate to the other side of the peninsula, it would be a traffic jam. It would be a disaster.
No, so, it would just be gridlock. I would think Darren Port Townsend had given this some thought with the munitions depot right across the bay.
Yeah, we actually have one of the guys that works at the munitions in charge of emergency response there. He's on our NPREP team, and it's a good conversation that we should have.
He has discussed it, and he says that basically that's the least of our worries.
Right.
Because everything is so well protected.
From an earthquake point of view.
Yeah.
The stuff won't detonate unless it's been set up to detonate. So it's in bunkers underground, and it would probably not be an issue for us. Mm-hmm. If somebody wanted to drop a bomb on us on Seattle, and the prevailing, and so you can check, you can actually go online and look at prevailing winds as it relates to a nuclear attack in a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the winds tend to go northeast. But you could have a bad day, in which case the wind's coming right up the Hood Canal. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Yeah.
One thing that we didn't mention is that after the event, for those of you that have a tent, sometimes you can just set up your tent inside your home. If you've got broken windows and things like that, and you can clean up the glass, but you can't get anybody out here to repair them, don't have any way of repairing them right away, you can set up a tent in your room.
After the aftershocks.
After
the big aftershocks.
Yeah.
Don't run right out there and put your tent up after the first quake. There's going to be aftershocks. I talked to a structural engineer on the mainland, and he said you're going to see aftershocks that could last, as you know, months, but the big ones could last at least 2 weeks. And you'll be able to kind of monitor those, because they should be getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and the frequency should be spread out. But I wouldn't immediately run inside and start setting up until, if you have a 9-point, you're going to have X amount of 8s and X amount of 7s, and all of those are big, and those will be aftershocks. And they'll all occur probably within the first couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. But it is an option for you to do also, rather than going out into a shelter someplace. You know, you can set up the tent in your home, and that way you're still here, because unfortunately, another fact of life, I hate to say it because it's just horrible, looters.
Yeah.
And the more isolated you are, they might say, oh, I've got free rein back here. And again, they may not even know you're back here. Who knows? It just depends. But that is a problem. And
we would suspend the no shooting zone.
Right.
Absolutely. Because if we lose power, our gate opens wide up. So
there isn't an infinite emergency center in this area.
I don't know if there's any memorandum of understanding with any of them, anything around here. I honestly can't tell you that. You might go online to our map, which you can get through by going to EOC, DEFCOEOC.org, and there's a map on there that will show you the organized neighborhoods, ham radios, operators, who's got FS, you know, if there's FSRs in the neighborhood. But there's also one that, one level that is talking about possible shelters. Unfortunately, we can't say you're definitely going to report to the Bay Club.
Because
Bay Club may be flattened.
Yeah, so
until the incident happens and we see what is still standing, that's another reason to listen to your radios, because you don't know. We won't be able to tell you where shelters are being set up at or anything until after the event, because my brother lived through the Thomas Fire down in Santa Barbara, Ventura County. He lives in Ojai. They were evacuated to the high school in Ojai. They were there for 32 minutes. And all of a sudden, you've got to leave. You've got to go to Ventura now because the fire's coming here. And it came within 50 feet of the high school. So they got evacuated. Well, people that weren't listening to the radio and paying attention, they were driving up from Oakview and places like that up to the high school, which is a good 20-minute drive, and then having to go back down to Ventura, which they were only 15 minutes from. Mm-hmm. So there's a 35-minute round trip, you know, plus that 20 to get up there, that they didn't have, you know, they didn't have to take that 20 minutes because that was 40 minutes wasted. Yeah. So you need to make sure you listen to the radios to know if you do have to evacuate, where they're going to be. But like I said, we can't tell you in advance because we have memorandums of understanding with a lot of places, but until the event happens, we won't know which ones are viable and which ones will be opening up.
Medical supplies, go ahead.
One last question.
Sure.
If it happens tonight at 2 in the morning, where's the safest place to be in your house while the event is taking place?
Do your duct cover and hold underneath a solid table.
Under a solid table.
Or, you know.
Probably not the glass top.
If you're in bed.
If I'm in bed.
If you're in bed, before you get into bed, take the mirrored ceiling down.
Or this chandelier with the spike on it.
That beautiful picture you have hanging over your headboard on a teeny little hook. It's got to go.
Uh-huh.
Right? Come up with something else to put over that. So you're going to want to try to make your house as earthquake friendly as possible. They call that non-structural stuff. Okay? So things that can fly, televisions and refrigerators, you can actually anchor your refrigerator into the hole and those kind of things. But when you're in bed, they tell you to stay in bed. Cover your head with a pillow. Turn over, cover the back of your neck with a pillow, cover your head, get under the covers, right? And ride it out. Because it starts to shake, and this could be 5 minutes, okay? And you're going to have to kind of play it by ear. But they say the best thing to do, if you're trying to run and you fall, and something falls on it, or the glass is breaking and flying out of your windows as you're trying to run, that could be a bad thing. If you're in bed and you're under the covers and it's shaking and you just hang on and ride it out there, that's probably the safest place for you to be in that moment.
Even though you're surrounded by windows.
That's why you have your covers and your pillow.
Think about it, because if you get up and try to go and things are coming at you and you're cut, now you got a problem.
How about under the bed?
If you can get under the bed,
but then things are going to be moving around. Somebody said that this could be almost like a train hit the side of your house. So, boom, you could get side thrust, you can get up thrust. This is probably going to have a lot of side thrust associated with it. So things are going to be all of a sudden moving and knock you off your feet. If you're in bed laying down on a soft surface, boy, there's probably not... There'll be exceptions, right? But it sounds like a pretty good place to be, right? Don't go into the door frames, right? Because door frames are going to do all kinds of weird things, and a door can swack and hit you in the face.
Okay. But all the glass windows. I mean, I've right, so a glass house.
We got to glass. Okay, you see this here? That's a shower door that spontaneously exploded. Shower doors, tempered glass, spontaneously explodes. There's hundreds of people in the United States, all over the world, that get cut to death. Some of them die because they happen to be in a place where a shower door exploded. Tempered glass is designed, unlike sheet type of glass here, or plate glass, that when it explodes, it's like kind of in a car, it goes into little pebbles, into little quarter-inch pebbles, right? In a car, they have something called safety glass, which has two pieces of glass with a piece of plastic laminated in between. We recently hit a deer. The deer landed in the windshield collapsed, but it didn't cut us, right? I'm standing in front of the shower door. I don't have my helmet, my headlights, my gloves, my boots, my coat, my raincoat. My
Why not?
I'm going to take a shower. I put my hand on the towel rail, and I was beginning to move the shower door, and it sounded like a shotgun went off. And my shower door, and I had one of these deals, boom! And as the tempered, safe glass, tempered glass is coming out of the frame, it's coming out in chunks before it hits the floor and goes into pebbles. It's safer than plate, because it's not shards in your eyes, but as it's coming down, it cuts my thumb, peels it back, 18 stitches, cut my tendon, right? So, I go to the local glass company, and I say, hey guys, can't you sell me a shower door, a replacement shower door, that's made out of safety glass that's got a coating on it? Well, we're required to sell you tempered, but I never heard anything about that. I go online and I research this. This is on FEMA. This is on Homeland Security. This is a problem. This is happening. It's happening in stoves. It's happening on glassware on your pots. It's happening all over the place. Not a lot, because I'm unique, but it's happening. I had sat next to a guy at VCOM, which is our volunteer emergency radio gang. He had a guy who was in the Navy, retired guy, is in the shower. Shower door exploded while he was taking a shower. His wife wasn't home. He got cut to death and died. Okay? So, what do? I go online and research this. I discover that, and I know this is a fact, because in Los Angeles, we lived in San Pedro. We had a view of the harbor. We knew after 9/11 there could be a dirty bomb that would knock our windows out. We had a house built in 1919, old glass. We had a two-year-old. We had safety coatings put on all of our windows. We had windows this size right here. Safety coating. It holds the glass together. The window might fall out, but it isn't going to turn into shards coming at you, right? It holds it in place. They make a coating. 3M makes a coating, just like the kind of coatings you put on large office buildings that are tinted, or the coatings that go in your car. They make a coating that you can apply to glass that will keep it intact for shower doors. They actually have a PDF cut sheet that says, coating for shower doors. Duh, right? So then I said, well, since I'm in the earthquake biz, I have a house I bought because I have a view of the Cascades. If that earthquake comes and all that glass ends up in my lap, forget about the 30 days, water per person. I ain't going to be around to drink it. So I'm looking at actually having my windows coated. The local Havelock guy is doing the research into it. He's trying to find a company to do the application. The coating itself is a little bit pricey, but it should go on relatively fast with a good team. So that's another thing we've added to our list of things. Because all of this stuff is coming at you. If the house does this on one of those windows, you can imagine what it's going to do. And it's plate glass, and it's going to like blow up all over the place. So just something to think about. Don't have a lot of research on it. Go online, Google it. It's there. Japan uses a lot of the stuff. But it's just something to think about. There you go. Anyway, so what was the question? It had something to do with glass, right?
That was it. Okay.
I'm a living proof.
Would you like a glass of wine or a cup of
water? Water would be good. Yes, ma'am.
I got water
in here. Yes?
The discussion starts with after disaster. I personally think the discussion at the end, we talk about what to do during the disaster is more important, because I grew up in Asia. I think in my whole life, I have experienced more than 100 times of earthquake.
Okay.
And to me, that we, as a kids, we were trained to tell you what is important. You made the right move during the disaster. You survived. If you don't, you don't talk about after disaster because you probably are gone. So even in Asia today, with earthquake proof building, most the training is very basic, is what to do during the disaster. First of all, if you can cover yourself with solid wood table or comforter, that during the earthquake. Actually, I just experienced earthquake in the middle of typhoon in August. It was just earth shaking and disaster. It's just horrible. And what you need to do for most of the building, you do not, because Asia, the building is skyscraper. They are very, very few single family house like this. So people are asked to go up, run as high as you can. The reason is when the if you have two store building, I will run upstairs because it collapses and you are on top, you're right, you are safe. But you are bottom, you are dead. You are more than dead.
The emergency rescuers are finding you faster.
Exactly.
At the top
you go up. You will see when earthquake happen in Asia, especially in Japan, everybody run up because that's the only ticket to survive. If you go down, you're trying to run out to the street, you kiss the death of goodbye. So this is the fundamental mentality and protocol that I was trained as a kid. And so I thought, even though it's not 100% applicable here.
No, it is.
In the Northbridge earthquake,
yes,
they had the first floor collapsed.
Yes.
And the second floor was still, you know, was where the first floor used to be. And working search and rescue for the company, they were going to go ahead and have us come out and help with that, except we weren't jackhammer trained, so we didn't get to go. But, yeah, the first floor was completely, and that's where all the loss of life came in.
Yeah.
So it makes there, right there, you've got an earthquake consultant. Okay. Seriously. We're talking the voice of experience here. So that's some very good stuff. I've lived through a couple of them, but nothing compared to the kind of things you probably have. So these are your assets right here.
Right.
Get to know what you're good at, what your life experience is, things that you're pretty proficient at, experiences you've had. I've got on one side of me a guy that managed apartment complexes. He's a great mechanic. I've got another side, I've got a firefighter, and a guy that goes out into the woods for months to fish, and he lives off of whatever is out there. He's a survivalist. I've got a policeman at the other end of the neighborhood. I've got a pilot. I've got a guy that's a marine expert, right? Good news, you're close to the water. This is the way they're going to be bringing supplies in. If your neighborhood is organized and you have a way to distribute supplies to your neighbors and to your community, you might be able to become a location where they might want to drop some food. So you need to get on the radar, become a ham person, attend these meetings, come to the NPREP meeting once in a while, get to know the network of folk, and make sure that you're in the group, that in the decision-making processes that go on. If you're on the water, that's a good sign. If somebody has access to a boat, that may mean that you could go to the Ludlow Harbor and pick up supplies because the roads are out of sight. So all of these things that you don't know that you have are assets. And you need to identify them, quantify them, and think about how to apply them. You know, so you'll be surprised how many skills you have.
Here's something that was sent out by one of our team members, and it's the definition of disaster. Is many people trying to do quickly what they do not ordinarily do in an environment in which they are not familiar. So you're not going to be familiar with life after 9.0, because that's going to be something totally foreign. You're going to be cut off, you know, more than likely. So your idea is to try and do quickly what you don't know how to do, basically. So that's why we're training you, is to give you ideas on what to do to make your life seem more normal.
And the definition, the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe is, in a disaster, you try to plan and become prepared enough that it's not such a big surprise that you just completely melt down. The catastrophe is when you haven't done any planning, and that's when you go out and meet your neighbors for the first time, and you don't have anything put away, and you haven't listened to any of these things that have been out there. So this doesn't have to be a catastrophe. You know, when you look at what's gone on in Puerto Rico and the Bahamas, those people just live to serve, because it's basically a service community. That's sad. And we've really got an understanding of how FEMA's going to respond. And it's sad. If we don't have fairly decent allies to come to our rescue, we're going to be in trouble, because this country is going to be tapped financially. And this would be the biggest natural disaster in the history of, God knows, North America.
Now, because we're not on the I-5 corridor, unfortunately or fortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in this case, we will not be getting the first supplies that come in.
And because we're not in Port Townsend, we won't be getting the 50th supplies that comes in, right?
Since no. Once it comes in, it will be divided up, with, as far as we've been told, with all of the communities, you know, as much as they can. Now, those that have trained, like we have Coyle Community, Port Calipoint,
Cape George,
and a few other neighborhoods like that, have actually trained through the DART program, which is Disaster Air Relief Team. They're going to be a group of pilots. In fact, they did an exercise a couple of weeks ago, brought in 5,500 pounds of food that all went to the food banks. From all over, we had a pilot from Lake Tahoe flying in. We had all over Washington and Oregon coming in.
These are little small bush planes. They're bringing supplies.
No, but my comment is, do they do the larger populations first?
Yes.
All the way through?
Oh, sure. Sure, yeah, if you got a couple million people.
Out here, we're going to be some of the last to get.
On the peninsula here, it's going to be pretty much, if you have the facility to get to pick it up, then you will be, you know, you may not get as much as the people in Port Townsend, but you will be able to get something to help.
They'll be going to the Seattles first, and it'll take longer to get to us. But what we're trying to do now through DART, and we're looking up setting up a boat fleet, a volunteer boat fleet, okay, so that we can leverage that transportation. Coyle, they have one or two roads into Coyle. They're going to have, most of their supplies going to come by boat. And so you want to get, by organizing, you get your NPREP number, your group number, you're on the radar. You're on the map. And at the EOC, they show, here's a neighborhood. It's called, whatever this neighborhood is called. And so you're on the map. And so then you become an entity that is identifiable, that somebody will respond to at some point. You'll have a ham radio. They'll be communicating. They'll be saying what the situation is, what your needs are. Are you ready to take supplies? Yes, we are. They're not dropping supplies off here unless they know there's somebody here to pick them up and distribute them. Puerto Rico, FEMA showed up with ships and the containers, and there was no plane to distribute them. You know, and Puerto Rico is the same size as the Olympic Peninsula. You know, so these are the things that we're doing to try to get out in front of this. You've got some really amazing people, and you can count them on one hand, on two or three fingers, at the DEM that are paid people, part-timers, and a lot of them not part-timers, we're not paid, but that are literally working out the logistics of response with the government, with the state, with the armed forces to respond to this area. And 2 years ago, they thought it was all handled, and And our team pushed the envelope on in the questions, only to discover there was no plan, it wasn't happening, it was all falling apart. They're making it happen. They're putting it together and making it a viable plan. So there's a lot to be thankful for there. But it requires your help. If you guys got your act together and you're resilient and you're taking care of yourself, then they don't have to send a lot of assets down here to spin their wheels, okay? And for the neighbors that are coming to you that don't have a clue, the other skill you need within your team is how to take the other 30% or 60% maybe that didn't show up tonight and put them to work and make them a valuable asset. I'm not sure how many people, you know what I'm saying? There's going to be other people showing up. So you just know that's going to happen. And nobody's going to be slamming the doors in people's faces saying, you know, you didn't show up at the meeting, so you're not going to get water.
You're always going to have spontaneous volunteers after the fact. Now, you need to make sure that you have somebody that says, okay, don't go out there and do that. That's not necessary at the moment. This is what we need to have done, and have the backbone to stand behind it. We've got two people in our neighborhood that have already said, well, we're just going to take our chainsaws out there and you're just not going to have any, you know, and okay, that's not going to happen necessarily in that order. You may have to do something else before you can get your chainsaw out. These two guys are chainsaw happy.
Gasoline will be locked up. Propane will be locked up. Fuel will be shut off. So if you don't have it in the neighborhood, you don't have it. So bulk LP tank storage, good idea. Wood, seasoned wood. You just don't go out in the tree, or you actually got a lot of, probably a ton of wood out there where they did the clear cuts. But for a lot of communities that all electric have, you know, nothing, no fuel, they think, well, we're going to go out and cut down a green tree and cook
don't,
it.
Don't, don't.
It ain't going to happen. So you don't need any fire starter. So
it gets very smoky.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you look at the accumulation of knowledge you have here, you can probably work these things out. It's all about organization. You know, now, the ham radio might call in to the EOC and say, here's our situation, this is what's going on. You're a neighborhood. There may be a sister neighborhood that needs something that you have. So one of the things that EOC does is they network the needs of the community, knowing the strengths of the individual communities. They may call you and say, hey, do you guys have an extra chainsaw? Do you have any gasoline? Do you have medical supplies? Another thing to note, we have a relationship with the Providence hospital chain. And down in Olympia, they have a huge warehouse down there where they collect outdated medical supplies from all of their hospitals. They put them on pallets, and they plastic wrap them, and they send them to the warehouse. If you go down and with a pre-planned time, and the DEM has a relationship with them, let's say you take a half dozen people down, you go down and you sort supplies off these pallets into bins for them, your free labor, they'll let you come home with as much medical supplies as you can carry in your vehicle.
Really?
Really. And we're talking thousands of dollars worth of medical supplies you can take out of there just because you're volunteering.
I have a trailer. Let's do it. You
know? So it's a good thing where the DWM, DEM is coordinating that. It isn't like a free-for-all. But you can contact the DEM and talk to them about you're interested in that. So it's just, these are some things that we're trying to do for the community.
The case for that program?
No, other than it's the Providence Medical Warehouse. The container idea, not a bad idea. Joyce has a community container. Schools have community containers. We're trying to get a community container for the high school. And basically, you can get a 40-foot container. They call them high cubes. And you want to get an insulated container so you can find an insulated container with a wood floor that's not contaminated, maybe aluminum siding on it.
Connex box.
Set it on some 4x4s or graver ties or something, or on gravel, and plumb some power to it, get some lights to it, and put your supplies in a container, build shelves in there. You can have a really good cache of supplies for a community, and that way everybody contributes. You know, you got your food team, you got your medical team, you got your fuel team, your lighting team, your, you know, your shelter team. How many tents? And that's what Joyce did. And they have a really good setup there. So they know they can count on that.
Beckett Point is in the process of setting up a tough shed. I know. And like I said, that other neighborhood, somebody had a shed on his property that he wasn't using, so he turned it over to them. They put a combination lock on there, and three or four people know the combination. So it's not open to everybody to be able to just walk in and, you know, have everything disappear all of a sudden. So there's different things that you can do. North Beach.
Here you go.